if you saw a list of the topics for this meeting, hopefully our title for tonight kind of piqued your interest. Tonight and tomorrow night, we're going to finish by talking about tactics for defending our faith. Now, just to set this up, I want to ask you, have you ever been in a situation where you were talking with somebody and you got to about religious things, about spiritual things? And you got to a point in your conversation where you just didn't know what to say. Maybe I don't even have to ask that question, but I think we've all probably been there at some point. I can't tell you the number of times that I've had conversations with people, and then not even 5 minutes later, I think, I wish I would have said this, or why didn't I think about what they said, or why didn't I pick up on that? That's what we're going to be talking about tonight, how to maneuver in our conversations with people as we try to talk about spiritual things. Now the nature of this is going to be a little bit different. I'll just go ahead and tell you ahead of time. We're going to be looking at some scriptures, but not as much as we've looked at up to this point. What we're going to be looking at, though, I think are some principles that we find in scripture, and principles that will help us use scripture more effectively. Now, just introducing this, what we're going to talk about over the next two nights, we're going to talk about seven different tactics. And what these tactics are, is they're ways to help people move closer to the truth. They're ways that we can also, in our conversations, determine people's motives. Ways that we can find out if the people we're talking with are really interested in the truth and in finding it, or if they've got some walls that they're building up to combat that. Now, I'll mention the seven that we're going to talk about in just a few minutes, but I want to do some background on this first, and I'd like to ask you to turn in your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, because I think there's a foundation to this. There's some things that we need to understand, first of all, before we ever talk about how we engage in conversation with people, that really, if we don't understand it, we're not gonna have very much success with this. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I want us to notice verses 3-5. Paul says, "For although we are walking in the flesh, we do not wage war in a fleshly way. Since the weapons of our warfare are not fleshly, but are powerful through God for the demolition of strongholds, we demolish arguments and every high-minded thing that is raised up against the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ." Now, I want you to notice there that Paul says some pretty important things about who our fight is against, and by implication, who it's not against. If we're going to be successful defenders of our faith, if we're, as Peter said, if we're going to be ready to give an answer for the hope that's within us, one of the first things that we have to do is we have to understand who our enemy is. And here's why that's important. When I first became a Christian and I first started trying to talk to people, I'd get in conversations, and my concept was, or at least this is how it played out, I don't know that I understood this, but a lot of conversations that I had with people came across as they were my enemy. And so instead of being diplomatic or being winsome in my manner, it was more like combat. Well, my purpose is to win this argument, and if I can show you that you're wrong, it doesn't matter how it makes you feel. If I have enough scriptures to counter your scriptures, and at the end of the day, my argument is superior than yours, then I win. Clearly my faith is better than yours. And for a long time, that's how I talked to people. But what I found out pretty quickly is that didn't work at all. And if anything, it discouraged people. It pushed them away. The reason that this text in 2 Corinthians 10 is so important is because I want you to notice again, who does Paul say our enemy is, or what are we fighting against? Verse 3 tells us we're not fighting against flesh and blood. We're not fighting fleshly battles. Instead, he says in verses 4 and 5 that we demolish arguments. We demolish high-minded things that are raised up against the knowledge of God. What we're fighting against are thoughts and ideologies and philosophies. And the reason that that's so critical is because the minute that I forget that, the minute that I forget that the battle is against ideas and It's a battle against spiritual enemies, and the walls are ideologies and belief systems. The minute I forget that is the minute that I stop trying to win souls and I start trying to win arguments. And if we understand nothing else about our calling, what we've been talking about so much, let's understand this. We're not here to win arguments. We're here to win people's souls. Let me just give you an example of that. I've seen this work in amazing ways, and you've probably seen this in your lives too. Maybe you've even lived it. When I first moved up to Minnesota, back in the summer of 2008, spring of 2008, there was a particular guy up there. He was not a Christian. His family was, his wife, his kids, all were Christians, very faithful family. And he had been in this environment around a Christian family for all of his married life. I mean, it was something like 20 years that his wife had, you know, tried to set the example for him. And he would, I mean, he'd never come to worship with her. He'd never show interest in biblical things. But that summer, a couple of things started to change his mind or get him to look into things that he hadn't looked into before. One of them was that his kids started having kids. And as he was around his grandkids, he was a doctor. And he started to realize that he couldn't make sense of all of the things that he saw in nature and in his grandkids and just all of the... He couldn't make sense of that without there being some kind of creator behind it. So they got him thinking, got the wheels turning. And what this guy demonstrates is what Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 10, you have people that spend their entire lives, they spend years putting up walls. And the purpose of these walls is to keep any and every idea about God out of their thinking. They won't even let it in. And they spend years and years putting up these walls and building these fortresses. And you notice what Paul says, what we're doing and what God's word has the power to do is to break down and storm those fortresses. And the amazing thing about it is if you've ever seen somebody whose will and whose walls have been broken down, you start breaking tiny holes into those walls, or you start giving them things to think about that are creating problems in the way that they've always thought. And it's not long before the whole thing comes falling down. Maybe you know how that goes because maybe at some point that's been you. You've put up the walls and they've been torn down. But that's, I think, where we have to start with this tonight, is we have to understand that that's what we're fighting against. We're trying to expose the lies that Satan gets people to believe in. It's also important, and we talked about this on Sunday night, that we understand our calling. Let's go back to Ephesians and look at a text that we didn't look at on Sunday night. Ephesians chapter 5, I want to read a few verses there. Ephesians chapter 5, and let's look at, let's start in verse 6. He says, "Let no one deceive you with empty arguments, for because of these things God's wrath is coming on the disobedient. Therefore do not become their partners, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord, and walk as children of light. For the fruit of the light results in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, discerning what is pleasing to the Lord. Don't participate in the fruitless works of darkness, but instead expose them, for it is shameful even to mention what is done by them in secret." Now, we'll just stop right there for now. But I want to ask you a question about this. So Paul says, okay, we're not supposed to be deceived. We're supposed to walk as children of light. Verse 11, he says, don't participate in the fruitless works of darkness. And my question about that how do we do that? Is it enough for us simply to not participate? I mean, are we doing our jobs as Christians if all that we do is we just step back from the lies that are being told and followed and the corruption that we see morally in people's lives? If we distance ourselves from that, are we doing everything we're supposed to do? Well, maybe. But I want you to notice what else Paul said we're supposed to be doing. He says, don't participate in them, but instead expose them. And I think what that means is that part of our work is that we're supposed to be actively not just removing ourselves from sinful behavior and from moral impurity, but we're supposed to be showing people the danger of that. And so there's kind of a twofold thing here. And these tactics that we're going to talk about tonight are designed to help us do that more effectively. Now, let me just show you a couple places that I think show us the need for tactics or the importance of them. Remember what Paul said to the Colossians in Colossians 4, verse 5. He said, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Remember also what Jesus told his apostles in Matthew 10, verse 16. When he says, when you go out into the midst of wolves, they were supposed to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. That implies tactic, or it implies a certain manner of trying to do things in a way that's not offensive, at least in the way that we portray things. Now, the message may offend people, but our job is to not let the offense come from our behavior and our conduct. Let's also talk about this, the burden of proof. I don't know if you guys have noticed this or not, but I've started to see it more since I've first heard about these and started thinking along these lines. But do you ever notice how in religious discussions, so often somebody will make an outrageous claim and then they'll pin the burden of proof on the Christian. And they'll say, your God is a monster because this, or the Bible's not true because of this. What do you say to that? Or why don't you disprove me? And the burden of proof always falls on the Christian, doesn't that mean we're the ones who always have to answer? Now, to be fair, I think what Peter talks about in 1 Peter 3 when he says be ready to give a defense, we have to be ready to answer those questions. But here's the thing. For too long, I think we as Christians have allowed people to do that to us. They make the claims and they never have to defend them. And to be quite honest, I get tired of seeing that. I think if people make claims, what we have to understand is that the burden of proof rests on them to prove their claim. If we've never said anything and then they make the claim, they're the ones who have to back it up. And sometimes instead of our tendency is somebody makes a claim and we want to immediately jump into disproving it. When some of the most effective things we can do are simply to ask people to verify or to prove their own claims. So we'll talk about that some more as we go along. Now, the benefits of these approaches, the benefits of these tactics that we're going to talk about, for one, are that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to use these tactics. Really what we're going to talk about are just common sense things. And so it's not something where we have to be Bible scholars or we have to know a whole lot about textual criticism or anything like that. These are things that we can simply use to advance conversations in productive ways. These tactics will also allow us to maintain control of our conversations, to try to keep them focused on the topic at hand. And these will also be useful because if you've ever run across somebody like this, sometimes you try to talk to people about the Bible, but what they doubt is not your understanding of some passage, they doubt the Bible itself. And the difficulty of that is that we can't use the Bible to prove the Bible to people who doubt the Bible. And so these tactics, another benefit of them is that we can use them when people doubt the Bible itself, we can use them to kind of get them to think, to expose flaws in their argument and things like that. Now, I'm just going to go ahead and mention these seven tactics. We're going to just cover two tonight, and those will be sort of the most involved ones, and then we'll cover the final five tomorrow night. But the tactics are these. Number one is called the Columbo tactic. Feel free to write these down. If I go too fast, we'll come back to each of them eventually. But the first one is the Columbo tactic. The second one is called the suicide tactic. And by the way, these aren't original with me. These are things that other people have come up with and given names to. And really, I think they're as old as human reasoning. But some people have just come up with catchy names for them. So that's the second one, the suicide tactic. Number three is called taking the roof off. Number four is Rhodes Scholar. Number five is called just the facts. And if you want, you can add ma'am after that. Number six is sticks and stones. And then number seven is steamroller. Now you can see by the names, you're probably starting to figure out what some of these are about, and that's good because these names are designed to get us to get these to stick in our minds. Tonight we're going to talk about the first two, the Columbo tactic and the suicide tactic. First of all, the Columbo tactic is really kind of the chief or the queen mother of all of these tactics. Of course, it's named after Lieutenant Columbo. You guys know him well, or at least I suppose most of you do. I don't know if Columbo Marshall was before your time. It probably was. You know who Columbo is? Okay. Columbo, for those of you who don't know, I mean, he's this lovable TV detective. I think Peter Falk was the guy that played him. But he always, his method was really unique. And I mean, you see him, he'd walk into a crime scene, and at the beginning of the shows, you, the audience would know who committed the crime. And usually Columbo could figure it out pretty quickly. The problem was he couldn't prove it right away. And so the rest of the show was him figuring out how to prove it. And he's such a, I mean, he's not the kind of guy you'd expect to be a brilliant detective. He's always wearing that brown, wrinkled trench coat. He's always got this stub of a cigar that he's chewing on, and I don't think he ever lights it. You know, he's always looking for paper and pencil, and he can never find anything. He's got the bed head, and I mean, just looks like he just rolled out of bed. And so he'll come into a crime scene and just kind of look around and poke at funny things. And eventually, he'll ask a question, right? He'll say, you know, I'm just thinking about this. There's just something about this that bothers me. And he'll ask the criminal this question, and usually they've thought out the answer. And so they'll give him an answer, and he'll say, oh, yeah, silly me, you know, that, okay. And then he'll kind of pause and scratch his head a little bit, and he'll say, well, but something about that, you know, bothers me. And he'll keep asking them questions, and one more thing, and one more thing. Pretty soon he's exposed the flaws in their alibis just by asking them questions. That's the Columbo tactic. The Columbo tactic, just simply defined, is using carefully selected questions to disarm the other person and productively advance the conversation. And basically, if you want to summarize this, the rule of the Columbo tactic is never make a statement when a good question will do. The point of these questions is, well, there's three, I guess, different things that we can achieve with these questions, but primarily, first of all, we ask questions to clarify. Sometimes the problem when we're talking to people about the Bible is that they make a claim and we start to address that claim and we give this long drawn out answer, and then at the end we realize that that wasn't even what they were claiming. And it just makes us look kind of foolish and irresponsible. And the benefit of the Columbo tactic is it allows us to first clarify what they're saying. And it gives them a chance for them to clarify, because sometimes people make claims and they don't really know what they're saying. They're just repeating claims that they've heard made over and over unchallenged. So that's one of the benefits of this. Another benefit of asking questions is that questions engage the person. Questions are interactive, and they engage the person in a way that's not attacking, and it's not putting people on the defensive right away, like a claim sometimes would. So it kind of gives people the opportunity to respond in conversation without putting them on their heels right away. Now, we're going to talk about three specific questions or variations of these questions that that sort of contain the essence of this tactic. The first one is, what I wanted to do with each of these is actually show that Jesus even used things like this. Now, Jesus didn't, I don't think he called it the Columbo tactic, but I want to just notice a couple places where Jesus uses this tactic of asking questions to expose flaws in the thinking of his audience. Over in the book of Matthew, he does it several times in just a span of two or three chapters. Matthew chapter 21, first of all, we find a scenario where his authority is being questioned by the chief priests and the elders, and they come up to him and they say, where did you get the authority to do what you're doing? And you notice how he answers them. Instead of giving a lengthy discourse about where he gets his authority, what does he say? He says, I will also ask you one question. And if you answer that question, then I'll answer your question. And so he does it there. Now later on in chapter 22, verse 15, the Pharisees come up to him again, and they try another question. They ask him, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? What does Jesus do in 22, verse 18? It says, but perceiving their malice, Jesus said, why are you testing me, hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax. And so they show him the coin, and he says, whose image and whose inscription is this? Another question. And then just a little bit further down in this same chapter, down in verse 41, he actually initiates the conversation. He comes up to them and he asks them a series of questions. And the point of this question is, it gets down to this question, if David called the Messiah Lord, then how can the Messiah be his son? And the great thing about that is with each of these questions, Jesus made a very, very strong point. That got across to his audience. And he never really made any claims there. Simply by asking informed questions and by listening to their questions and being observant, he used questions to expose flaws in their thinking. Now, those are some biblical examples. Let's talk about these three key questions in the Columbo tactic, and then we'll look at some examples that we run into often. First example, or first question, is simply, what do you mean by that? When somebody makes a claim, just ask them, okay, what do you mean by that? Can you clarify that a little bit for me? And this is simply designed to, before we say anything, to make sure that we understand what they're claiming. It's simply a question that brings in more information. The second question is the question, how did you come to that conclusion? And this is the question where we ask them for evidence. Now, what's interesting about this is sometimes you ask people this first question, what do you mean by that? And they're not even sure what they mean by that. Again, they sometimes are repeating claims that they've heard and they've always gotten away with them. But it'll pause and cause them to think about what they're saying. You ask them the next question, how did you come to that conclusion? Now, and sometimes you'll have plenty of people who will say, well, here's my reasons for believing this. But sometimes you'll catch people that have never really thought it through. They've never really considered evidence or looked at the evidence for their claim. And if that's the case, then you can get them to see that. And then the last question, maybe you go a little bit further and you examine their evidence or lack of it. And the final question is some variation of this. Well, have you ever considered... and then present some alternative or present the belief that you hold. Now, each of these questions, you can have different variations of this. Let me just talk about a few examples of this. By the way, it's interesting that someone at some point has pointed out that you notice that a question mark is shaped kind of like a fish hook. We use questions to draw people into... conversation. Now, let me just issue this disclaimer. This isn't to be underhanded, and this isn't trying to be sly about things. These are things that we should be honest about. I mean, as Christians, if we practice what we preach, if we truly believe what we claim, then aren't we simply interested at the end of the day in truth? And so questions are the way that we arrive at that. We should be interested in what people have to say and how they answer our questions. So, one example of this, somebody throws a claim out there like this. There is no God. There's no such thing as God. Well, maybe you can think of some different ways to answer that. But if we try to use the Columbo tactic, maybe what you could do right off the bat is simply say, well, what exactly do you mean by that? Because when they say there is no God, they may have something entirely different in their minds from what we think of. They may be thinking of God in terms of like the Greek gods that sit up in their ivory towers and they punish man for bad things and they're kind of fickle and they mess with people and they just like to trick people. And if that's their concept of God, well then we don't believe in that kind of God. We can agree with that. But the point is simply to clarify what do they mean by that when they say there is no God. And then you can proceed from there. Or how about this one? Somebody makes the claim, the Bible's been changed. You can't trust it. Well, what exactly do you mean by that? The Bible's been changed. I think people are so used to hearing that on TV and on radio and reading it in print that a lot of people who make that claim couldn't really tell you what they mean by it's been changed. Do you mean that over centuries men have literally changed it to fit what they wanted, or do you mean that some manuscripts have been altered unintentionally, or what do you mean by that? And then from there we can proceed in our discussions. Or let's consider this one. Somebody says all religions are basically the same. Oh, really? Well, how so? Or what do you mean by that? And again, you clarify and then proceed from there. Now, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next one. But you get the idea here of the Columbo tactic. And we'll see this in play. The reason I say that it's kind of the queen mother of all these is because all the rest of these tactics really center around asking informed and observant questions. And then looking at the rest of these. Okay. Now, tactic number two, and by the way, I know I'm going through this kind of quickly. If you have any questions about this, feel free to ask me about anything if it's unclear or if it doesn't make sense afterwards. I'd be happy to talk to you about that. The suicide tactic. The suicide tactic plays on the fact that sometimes people make claims that are self-destructive. In other words, they're trying to prove a rule that the claim itself violates. And so the suicide tactic is simply recognizing and exposing when that happens. let me just mention some examples of this. And we're familiar with this. I mean, we hear things like this all the time. How about this one? I cannot speak a word of English. You see what I've just done? I've made a claim that I can't speak English, but I've spoken English to demonstrate the claim. What does it do? It commits suicide. Or how about this one? Never say never. Okay? Well, I just did the very thing that I said I would never do. Or how about this one? There are no sentences longer than 5 words in the English language. We see these kind of funny things, and there are all kinds of examples of this. I was doing my taxes last year, and I noticed this on one of the pages. I'd printed them all out, and I was going through them and just double-checking everything. And I got to one, and I promise you, it said this. It said, this page intentionally left blank. And I just kind of wondered, well, okay, who figured that one out? and you see what that is. I mean, these claims that we often read over, and they're just kind of silly, but when you get down to it, they're violating the thing that they're trying to prove. You guys remember the old Yankees catcher, Yogi Berra? He was like the master of this. He said things like, you should always go to other people's funerals, otherwise they won't come to yours. Just think about that one for a second. Or another one of his most famous was, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded, right? Well, how can it be too crowded if nobody goes there? So, I mean, we see some humorous examples of this, but we actually see this in Scripture as well. I want you to consider what James says in James chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. in this discussion that James has with his audience about the role that works play in our faith, I remember how James kind of starts that whole section. Verses 15 and 16, he says, if a brother or sister is without clothes and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace and keep warm and eat well, but you don't give them what the body needs, what good is it? That's a self-destructive argument. I say, go and be filled and go and be warm, but I don't do anything to make that happen. I've just destroyed the very thing that I was trying to make happen. Or another one, over in the book of Romans chapter 2, verse 1, I want you to look at what Paul says there. He writes to his audience and he says, therefore, any of you who judge or who judges is without excuse, for when you judge another, you condemn yourself, since you, the judge, do the same things. So here his audience was condemning some people for certain sins, and yet, on the other hand, they were over here committing other sins, or maybe even the same sins. And he says, don't you understand that when you do that and when you pass condemnation on people who are practicing the same things that you practice, you're condemning yourself. It's a self-destructive argument. Now, for the rest of our time tonight, I want to look at some of the most common ones of these that come up. we'll leave it right there for now. How about this one? Have you ever heard somebody make this kind of claim? there is no such thing as absolute truth. That is becoming more and more popular in the culture in which we live today, this claim of moral relativism. There's no such thing as absolute truth. Well, we could answer that by trying to defend that right off the bat. But can you think of a good Columbo question that might expose the flaw in that? You see the flaw in that? There's no such thing as absolute truth. Really? Oh, absolutely. You see, what they've done is they've made a claim that their statement is absolutely true under every circumstance. Or maybe this one. You hear somebody say, you know, the problem with you Christians, you guys know where this is going, right? The problem with you Christians is that you're always judging people. The problem with his statement is that in that statement, he's just judged you. Now, maybe you can just point that out, but again, think back to the Columbo tactic. And here's the benefit of this. Instead of just pointing something out, which you could do, ask questions and let them see it for themselves. Because a lot of times that'll stick with people a lot more than if you expose them and make them look bad. So if somebody says, the problem with you Christians is you're always just so judgmental. Maybe you could ask them a question like, well, so what's wrong with that? I mean, what's the problem with that? To which they might reply, well, I think it's wrong to judge. You shouldn't judge. And then you can just simply ask them the question, well, then why are you judging me? Or another kind of similar example of that. Well, okay, you shouldn't push your, I mean, it's okay for you to believe what you want to believe, but you shouldn't try to push your morality or force your morality on me. Well, let's think of a good Columbo question for that. How about this one? What? Okay, is that your morality? Or is that what you believe? To which probably they'll reply, yes. Unless they see where this is going, maybe they get it right off the bat. But all you simply have to say is, if that's your morality, then why are you trying to force that on me? And the point of this, again, is that people so often make claims that we let them get away with. And we try to immediately defend them without, first of all, pointing out the error in their thinking. How about this one? Sometimes you hear people say this, you can only know what's proven scientifically or what's scientifically verifiable. When you think about that, there's a problem with that claim, because the claim that they've just made, how do they know that? Well, first of all, are they claiming that that's true? Which they probably would. And then you can simply ask them, well, how do you know that that's true? I mean, how do you know that you can only know what's proven scientifically? Has that been proven scientifically? I mean, have you seen a test or something run in the lab that proves that? Now, you see, part of this is learning to be diplomatic and winsome, because it's really easy to come across as sarcastic and kind of mean-spirited. But the challenge for us is to try to simply make the point to people. I'm not trying to make you look bad. I'm just simply trying to get you to think about what you're saying. And the thing is, that claim has problems with it on several different levels. First of all, you can't test that claim. But second of all, there are all kinds of instances in which we know things to be true that can't be tested. Let me ask this question to those of you who are married. Do you know that your spouse loves you? How? I mean, is there some test you can run to prove that? I've never seen one. But we know things like that to be true. We believe them to be true. We believe in things all the time to be true that can't be tested. I believe that there's a brain in my head. I guess you can test that if you wanted to. But I believe that it's there whether there's a test to run on that or not. Now, some would debate that. But that's another example. Let's look at a few other examples. How about this one? All religions are equally true and valid. And this is, again, another pretty popular claim in our culture today. Well, every religion, everybody's okay. I mean, you can do whatever you want to. It's all the same. It's all equally true and valid. And maybe you can think of some questions to ask about that or some ways to word that. But I'll just talk a little bit about the conflict of that. If I'm a Christian, if I'm a follower of Christianity, and your claim is stating that all religions are equally true and valid, The problem lies in the fact that Christianity claims that not all religions are equally true and valid. And so either Christianity is true and all other religions are false, or Christianity is false and all the others are true, but you can't have it both ways. Now, there's more places to go after these initial conversations or discussions, but the point is that we simply show people where their logic is coming up short. A few years ago, there was a debate that was held between a guy named Greg Kokel, who's a guy that spends a lot of time teaching these tactics and trying to show the benefit of them. A guy named Greg Kokel and a professor named Dr. Marv Meyer at Chapman University. And the debate was, I think the title of it was something like, "Is Truth True?" And Greg Kokel's his side of things is he was trying to prove that you could know truth absolutely. Marv Meyer was claiming that there was no way to absolutely know truth. Now, the way Greg Kokel handled this, and I think it was really brilliant, is right from the very beginning he realized that there was a flaw in the premise of this debate from the very beginning. If Marv Meyer was trying to prove that there was no such thing as absolute truth, but he believes that absolutely, then the whole premise on which he's trying to argue is flawed. And that was all that he came back to during the debate. And at the end of it, when they were kind of making their closing statements, he said something like, "Dr. Meyer's done a great job, and I hope a lot of you vote for him and everything. But I want you to just think about what you're saying if you vote for Dr. Meyer. Because the claim that he's made is that there is no absolute truth. And if you vote for him, you're claiming that he's proved that that is absolutely true. So really, a vote for Dr. Meyer is a vote for me." And he left that with his audience, and a lot of people kind of laughed about it. But at the end of the debate, I don't know how many people were there, but I think only one or two people voted for Dr. Meyer. And it was simply a matter of pointing out flaws in people's logic. Another one that comes up often is, well, the Bible can't be trusted because it's written by men, and men are fallible. They make mistakes. Let's think about that in Columbo terms. Okay, so you're making this claim, and you are a man. You're a human. How can I know that the claim that you're making isn't a mistake? How can I, if humans are fallible and they make mistakes, how can I be sure that the claim that you've just made isn't one of those? Or sometimes people will talk about this one. This has become popular. People believe that God created the world, but he did it through Darwinian evolution. The problem with that is that when you understand what Darwinian evolution really is, it's the creation of life through natural processes that excludes the possibility of something supernatural, some creator. And so when people say that God created the world through Darwinian evolution, those are two incompatible ideas. The ideas, the concept self-destructs. Let's look at a couple more tonight, and then we'll wrap this up. Sometimes people, when you're talking to them about your belief in God, they'll say, "Well, I can't believe in God because there's too much evil in the world." And so they'll argue against the existence of God because of the existence of evil. A great question you can simply ask is, first of all, well, what do you mean by evil? Or what is evil? And then they may define it. A lot of people, when you ask them that question, they'll say, "Well, I mean like murder or rape or stealing." And what we have to understand, or what we have to hold them to, is that's not evil. That's giving examples of it. It's not defining it. Don't let them give examples. And so then when they define it, ask them, "Well, why is that evil? Or why are those things that you mentioned evil? What is it about them that's evil?" And eventually where they'll get to is that there has to be, those things are evil because on some level they violate a standard of good. And the problem that creates is, okay, I can't believe in God because there's evil in the world. Well, how do you define evil? You define it based on this absolute standard of good. Really, the existence of evil, I think, is one of the best arguments for the existence of God, when we really think it through. Or one more. we'll see this, or this comes up sometimes in our culture. People who are homosexual will try to argue for the right to adopt. And they'll do it in a really inconsistent way. They'll argue for homosexuality because they say it's natural. I mean, as long as I've been alive, I've always had these urges. And we'll actually look at that argument tomorrow night in another tactic. First of all, there's never, that I know of, there have never been any studies that have proven or shown anything, any kind of conclusive evidence. But you'll have people that make that argument, and then they'll say, I believe that people who practice homosexuality should be allowed to adopt. But you have two incompatible ideas here. If the basis for their reasoning is doing what is natural, then what are the natural consequences of homosexuality? They are that you can't have children. And adoption is actually doing something that is very unnatural. And so if that's their line of reasoning, we simply point out that the flaw in that. Now, they may try to make another argument for that, but that's simply another example of the suicide tactic. We'll stop with that for tonight. There's a lot of examples of this, but I hope you see how this works. And I hope this will get your mind thinking. Really what this comes down to is simply being more observant in our conversations with people. It reminds me of what James said in James chapter 1 when he said, let everyone be quick to hear, quick to hear and slow to speak. Now in that context, he's talking about anger and things like that, but I think it also applies to our conversations. Sometimes we want to just dive right in at the earliest opportunity, but the best possible thing we could do is simply listen to the person we're talking to, and then consider the claims that they're making, and then go from there. We'll pick up with this tomorrow night and talk about the last five tactics. Thanks for your attention tonight. Go ahead and take your songbooks out. We're going to sing number 601. If there's anybody here this evening, again, I know that tonight we haven't really spent a whole lot of time looking at what a person needs to do to become a Christian. But maybe you're here tonight and that is your need. If you know what you need to do tonight, why not wait? Or why wait? I don't know what I'm saying. Sorry. Don't wait. Make this the night you make that right. If you have something in your life that needs to be made right with God, that's lacking, something you need to correct. If you have something that you're struggling with that you just like prayers for, or help with, anything we can do to help, if you have a spiritual need, come to the front and let us know what we sing this song.